So I've asked Andrew to do something almost impossible, to play sight unseen on the slightly out of tune piano, or sight unseen for a long time, probably the most complex mystical piece in the whole Gurdjieff canon. But hey, this is Andrew Schiabosch, he can do anything.
Thank you.
I don't think I've ever heard that piece more beautifully played. Steinway's notwithstanding. Thank you, Andrew. Thank whatever worked through your fingers. Wow. And of course, I don't need to tell you the reason I love that piece is because it's so extraordinarily expansive and spacious and luminous. And it connects the kind of luminosity of the expansion that that first part of the Four Ideals exercise leaves you with. It connects it properly, cosmically. And I think forms the backdrop against which I'd like to do some of the introduction of the material for this afternoon, which is going to start out a little bit harder core and then lighten up and hopefully move rather rapidly to some interesting developments which may or may not get shared at this session. But I promised you I'd give you my take on what I heard from Eva last night. And I want to use that as a way of starting into the teaching that I want to give this afternoon. I don't want to neglect the fact that conversation is in order and no doubt has already happened over numerous picnic tables. But we will have a full conversation. But I'm also aware of the capacity, the potential sometimes of conversation to dissipate an energy that if you hold together in a different way, you can push it forward. So I'm not sweeping things under the rug, but just trying to sequence things in a time that the energy that we're building doesn't get dissipated. So the most strongest takeaway that I heard in the conversation last night was that we're dealing with at least an 18-month life cycle of this pandemic, that we may be about approximately halfway through right now. That viruses and pandemic cycles seem to have a life of their own. And she was saying, oh, by this time next year, we'll probably be back, how did she say it, good to go or back to speed. But essentially, assuming that we've got, you know, another basically year of this, almost a year of this to soldier through, because she started the gates at her 18-month estimate at February, which means that people's happy scenarios of, by Thanksgiving, by Christmas, by January, you know, by the starting gate for when it'll all be back to normal continues to slip. And she suggested what I heard last night was that rather than just deal with the situation what they do with the delayed flights in the airport where they feed it out to you by 40-minute intervals, it's delayed another 40 minutes, it's delayed another 40 minutes. Why don't they just tell you from the start it's delayed five hours so you can go get your cup of coffee? So she gave us, you know, a sort of running fixed take on what would seem to be statistically the life cycle of a pandemic, drawing some parallels with the swine flu in 1918. And interestingly enough, she didn't seem too flapped by the vaccine. It wasn't like we're going to have she sort of suggested that you know, maybe by January we would be online with you know, the it would be in process, but she said it's basically a 3-month out. And there was no sort of factoring in, well, we'll get the vaccine by January and by March we'll be back to business. She wasn't holding out that kind of hope, which a lot of Americans are just sort of pinning everything on, we'll get the mystery vaccine. She says, think long term. The other thing that I kind of pushed her on that I was interested in just at the end was that while we hear wildly that you know, some countries are doing better than others, and while there's a tendency to say that the ones that got on there fastest and firstest are better off, you know, and have it behind them and are moving on, that's not in point true. And that she and I knew that anyway from all my world contacts, you know, that you let the thing up just a little bit, and some of these countries that were models of COVID decorum, and boom, right back. And her whole idea of restrain and relax, which I hadn't heard before and was really a brilliant piece, that you just kind of ease your way back. You open it up and then you get, of course, outbreaks, and you clamp it down, but for a shorter time. Then you open it up again, clamp it down. And you have to gradually ride it till it comes to the end of its lifespan. She didn't use the words herd immunity, but she did talk about how, you know, well, it marched up the East Coast and the West Coast, it marched across the South, and now it's heating up the Midwest, almost as if it's going to follow its trajectory. So against that, it was clear to me that the measures that she's talking about, the recommended best practices, are essentially spoken from a public health standpoint, you know, that they're mitigation practices that are really intended, as she came right out and said, to control an uncontrollable rate of spread, so that it doesn't overwhelm the systems. And she spoke about a couple of systems, which was really interesting, that so that it doesn't overwhelm the healthcare system, obviously, but also so that it doesn't overwhelm the basic structures of society. She says, you know, if we all do these practices together, we can slow down the spread of it enough so that we can maintain something that resembles a normal life. You know, we can gather in groups like this, you can go back to school, people can go to work. It doesn't completely overturn all the structures of society. So you limp around with it, and you certainly see that right here in Stonington. We have had a tourist season. It hasn't been a tourist season like tourist seasons they're used to. There were no lobster boat races or clam bakes or 4th of July parades. But the inns were full. The restaurants were at full capacity. People are surviving. So it's a very, her point of view is from a public health standpoint, which is where she's been really working with the Center for Disease Control, and it's clear between the lines, and I think not well enough known in the public, that these measures, these best practices, the distancing, the masking, do not prevent death, but slow its rate. You know, that often people have a sense that if we just do this, the disease will go away. But, you know, these are not curative matters. They're not cures. They're not preventative measures. They're breaking controls to keep things under control. And when seen that way, they're entirely sensible. And they're at absolutely no clash whatsoever with the kinds of alternative possibilities I'm laying out here. It's absolutely true and it's been brilliant. Brilliant in allowing us to maintain something of a semblance of normal life. And I also heard her say really clearly that you know, as in terms of long-range prognosis, first of all, she underscored the fact that we were getting very poor information. And to hear a person who's that prominently positioned in the whole pipeline say that, and to say that doctors are coming to her, and others to say, well, what's going on? You know, what should we do? Suggests, you know, woefully how we are dealing in a scene of partial information, skewed information, and filtered information that makes it very, very hard for everybody to get a comprehensive enough picture so that it's not just blind armies shooting pistols at the dark at each other. She did have a strong sense that chemical warfare was not the way to go, that every time you up the ante with a new chemical solution to a problem, you simply raise the stakes for everything, and that she would really strongly advocating that rather than just trying to find some new razzle-dazzle medication that would, you know, hold the whole thing under control by pharmaceutical means, that we begin to look over the more long term at healing the broken links with the natural world, and de-escalating the circumstances in that way. So those are some of the takes I heard. I think it was very, very lucid. It was sobering in some ways, because people really don't want to know. You know, they don't want to think on the kind of time scale yet that really, from her experience modeling and looking at a scientist and seeing the similarities between these things she's seeing, you know, she didn't hold out any hope that we're going to have a panacea in the next 6 months. But it's a matter of managing over a longer term than most of us had originally bargained for. And it's at that point that I think that that the piece that I have to contribute from the imaginal perspective fits in. Because, first of all, the other thing to say about her is that she was also speaking from her expertise, which is in, you know, in modeling and in very, very sophisticated predictions of patterns for control of, you know, diseases over huge populations. That's her expertise. She didn't try to comment, and it's not her standard, it's not her field in which she has standing, on the medical models. I didn't ask her about the hypoxia, the ACE inhibitors, the statins, all this other stuff, because she's not speaking as a medical person. She's speaking as a person whose job is to predict and control the spread of disease as a public health issue, and who has some brilliant models for doing that. So there were a lot of part of the discussions that it would not have been profitable to pull her into, because it's, you know, she would be speaking as a lay person among lay people. But to see clearly where that perspective lay was, I thought, really clarifying to me. What I can see very clearly is that 18 months is too long for the human spirit to survive under such conditions. It just Because at this time, and we're already beginning to see this, then along with the along with the physical effects of the disease, you've also got the psychological, spiritual effects that go hand in hand. And so that there's in point of fact, at all times, there's two diseases. There's actually three diseases, if you want to call it that. There's the disease that affects the physical body. There's the disease that affects the personal psychological body. And there's the disease that affects the collective psychological body, the pain body of the trauma. And the two middle ones, the personal psychological and the collective psychological, are at this point getting too damaged to not deal with. We can't believe that when you're already getting 140 people writing in saying, yay, brother, to Matthew's post about depression and burnout, that we're going to get through another 9 months doing what we're doing without psychic health. And what really worries me is how I watch ritualistic behavior beginning to set in, certainly individually and certainly groupally. You know, people driving alone around as sole occupants of a car wearing their masks. People crossing the streets to avoid each other. People not speaking to each other because, you know, this deep shadow, this fear of the stranger, this inward amygdala recognition of the other as dangerous to yourself, which is what we're acting out on the streets every day, is not going to be easily eradicated. We already have a proclivity in that direction. Fearfulness of embrace, of touch, all these things that have made us human, these things are not going to be erased out of the individual pain body or the collective pain body easily. And they're going to continue to have their PTSD effects on into the next generation with the children, with the, you know. So, and if it goes for even this, you know, reasonably predicted next time, it's going to be reified so much worse. So the sense is that at some point the work has to be done of shifting the atmosphere. So that, remember we talked, and Don nailed it this morning, talking about that just as the fruits of the spirit have their vibrational signatures in this world, so do what you might call the fruits of the devil. You know, the fruits of World 192, wrath, hatred, anger, fear, depression, catatonia. These things are also toxins in the planet. And that somehow the work has to be done of purifying this planet of these toxins that this traumatic calamity, perhaps self-inflicted, perhaps not, but the damage is real. And the work has to begin now of starting to defuse and clean up that mess, because the human psyche is not easily going to be bounding back from the kind of hits. That we're simply going to have to, like Babette, put into the atmosphere the missing ingredients so that the people can find their way back to the essential humanness which is in them, but has been repressed, suppressed in the interest of survival. It's like thawing out the planet. And it's work that has to start. Has to start now. And it has a certain risk to it, which I'm going to talk about tomorrow. And of course, a physical risk, a psychic risk. To do it, you have to do it clean, which means that there's a readying of your own soul. But there are approach routes which are, in some sense, less all stakes. So what I wanted to do, with that as the general backdrop, and not forgetting the canopy of spaciousness that the Bokharian dervish has woven above our heads, to talk about air. Because Mary Ellen again cut to the chase yesterday morning when she says that one of the most toxic effects of this disease is that it's making us scared of air. It's making us scared to breathe. And this is, as far as I can see, a radical and dangerous misunderstanding of the whole issue of aerosols, that has been translated into the idea that, you know, you could get the disease if you walk down the street and you're breathing next to a person who's got the disease, and so all of a sudden everything has gotten even more scary. And I think part of the reason why you see everybody walking around masking when they're walking the dog alone on the street at 6 a.m. Is because, again, as learned behavior, this is beginning to sink in, that masks have become our totems, our amulets, protecting us against the big, bad, scary thing, which is exactly the thing we're going to need to turn to and use as spiritual practices of all stripes have used since the beginning. Which is the cleansing and healing and information exchanging and purifying properties carried in air. So with that as the kind of prologue, Gurdjieff, of course, told us as one of the fundamental bits of his teaching that there are three foods needed for human survival. And they are, of course, food, physical food. Pardon?
Chocolate.
Chocolate, yeah. Chocolate, well, that's a category all to itself. It comes from Holy Son Absolute. So, those that like it. But so the physical food, then there is air, and the third is impressions. And these are being foods that coat not only the lower being bodies, but the higher being bodies, as Gurdjieff used to say. Where is the thing I read? I think it's 518-ish or so. God, why don't I bring my glasses? Vanity, vanity, all is vanity.
Here
you come with the ones. The good news. The good news is I can see. The bad news is I've got about 5 minutes and they make me want to throw up. So, thank you, my dear.
Pleasure, my dear.
So remember, this is the teaching as he puts it out in the chapter in Hypnotism and Beelzebub. And the substances are, of course, all carried in the blood appropriate to each realm. The substances of that part of the being body designed by nature for serving the planetary body arise from the transformation of substances of that planet on which the given being is formed and existed. In other words, that's our physical food. That's our crops. And we're beginning to pay attention, finally, to the fact that it makes a difference about how we raise them in terms of what their health value is to us. But that's first being food. Second being food is air, he says. But the substances designed for serving the Kesjan body, that's the imaginal body, the one that takes us into that realm, which in their totality are called Hamblodzon, the blood of that realm, are obtained from the transformation of elements of other planets and of the sun itself of that system, where the three-brained being has the place of his arising and existence. In other words, the substances we need for building up of our second body come to us from within our solar system, as we call it, the sun and the planets. And they are in the atmosphere, and they are ingested by breathing. Now, of course, obviously, breathing also serves the first planetary body as well. If you stop breathing, you stop enjoying your chocolate, except for Don. He'll take it with him into imaginal universe.
I can hold my breath a long time.
Yeah. You and Johnny. But anyway, the whole idea is that in this case, that breathing is the major milieu by which we take in the second being food, the ones that coat our that particular body that builds up our capacity to already dwell and imaginal in World 24. So it's all about breathing. And Gurdjieff's way of languaging this is simply saying something that's been picked up in virtually all the other spiritual practices. There's very few traditions that don't have a conscious breathing practice, because there's an intuitive recognition that there's something powerful that goes on here. And then third, finally, that part of the being blood which almost everywhere is called the sacred Aeskaldkledon, and which serves the highest part of our being, called the soul, derives from the direct emanations of the most holy Sun Absolute. And he goes in on to say, but the substances needed for coating and for perfecting the higher being body, that is the Kesjan body, enter into their common presence through their breathing, and also through certain or what are called pores in their skin, which incidentally is a part of the understanding that still exists in the Near East and which the West has forgotten almost entirely. You know, if you wonder why Gurdjieff loved his Turkish baths, and why my teacher Murat Yegin, who was a Circassian, you know, went every day to the brushing of his body with a wire brush, because there was this deeper realization than the West has at all, that the pores of the skin are also breathing units for ingesting the second being food and need to be treated sacredly. Let that note to the wise. But then, as for the sacred cosmic substances required for the coating of the highest being body, which they call the soul, these substances can be assimilated and correspondingly transformed and coated in them, just as in us, only through the process of what is called Aesitorian contemplation, actualized in their common presences with the conscious participation of their three independent spiritualized centers. And you will properly go, huh, about that. Mm-hmm. But what Aziz does is unpack that very beautifully. He says that basically what he's talking about is transformed contemplation. Gurdjieff actually called that Aesitorian contemplation. and named it in the exercise, meaning three-centered awareness plus an impression. Okay? Impressions are the three being foods. And impressions, remember when we were having this conversation with Bob this morning about cleaning? And I talked about my work teacher, and she says, when you're cleaning, what you're doing is creating impressions. Can you still remember the smell of your beautiful one on the first date you ever had? Can you still remember? There's some things that jump out in our life with such vividness that you never forget them years and years later. I can still remember watching my second daughter popping out on delivery, and there was about 30 seconds when, you know, her head was out and her rest of her wasn't out, and I had this distinct impression that this is the only time in my life I'm going to see this human being without interacting with it with gender. And it, you know, I still remember that impression to this day. But you know, sometimes we take in impressions more vividly than others. Oxytocin is a great impression booster, which is why everybody loves to fall in love. I can remember almost every day I spent on the cruise with Johnny, for better or worse, because it was just so alive. And these things grill into our soul and become the stuff of our soul. And we realize how stale most of our life is. I walk through the town and I don't see anything. I inventory. Oh, there's the coffee shop. There's the, you know, there's the, you know. But to see, to take in. And when we take in a conscious impression, according to this teaching, we're feeding the highest part of ourselves. That it's actually food that comes from Holy Son Absolute. But it requires, as Aziz brilliantly unpacks, three-centered awareness plus an impression. Three-centered awareness creating presence plus an impression. And if you have that kind of conditions, you don't have to rely on oxytocin and falling in love. You can create vivid, conscious impressions out of every moment of your life, as the saints and madmen do. Simply because you see with the whole of yourself there, and if you really say in a way that your soul is what you remember so powerfully, that it becomes a script of yourself that you can't pull out of, that you never forget, that it's going to consist not of all these, not of the 79 times in your life you paid your income tax. It's going to consist of those moments that jumped out at you because of the rare quality of their presence. So Gurdjieff talks about this is the highest being food. And we're not going to be specifically dealing with impressions in this particular teaching, but I thought since we have to at least touch base with it, that's the teaching on it. We're going to be looking mostly at breathing at this point, and breathing as it affects, you know, as it affects our capacity to participate in the healing and the re-equilibration, reintegration of a fractured biosphere. But very interestingly, I can't resist this, that Gurdjieff maintained a couple of pages later that what happens, he says essentially, that these high cosmic substances are flowing to us all the time. You know, the emanations from Holy Son Absolute, from our planetary system, are entering our atmosphere all the time. they're not sneaky, they're not hard to find. They're flooding us like meteor showers. But the reason they're doing that is because they require transformation. Once again, this whole map of the great megalocosmos that we've looked at, you know, they're coming down, they're going to undergo some processes, they're going to get kicked around and back in the evolutionary cycle again to maintain the equilibrium of the whole. So the fact that the sparks are coming down from heaven, if you want to call it that, doesn't bring, oh, let's just catch the sparks. It's that we have the obligation and the physical structure given to us to catch these because we are required to transform them. Not for our personal enlightenment, but for the health and balance of the whole system. Does that make sense at all?
Yes.
And
for the sake of those of us that are slower, or maybe just for my sake, could you give us a couple of very brief hands-on
examples
of one of these sparks or three of these sparks?
Yeah.
I mean, like, let's say three sparks that you were able to apprehend today.
Yeah.
Chocolate.
Yeah. No. Let me think about that, Don. I can't answer that right off in a way that's glib, but the question will work on me, and when I'm ready to answer it, I will. But vivid moments that come to you, vivid impressions more out of the life of things. You know, if you find it all the time because you're that kind of a guy. You walk down the street and you ask who people are and in 3 days in this town you know more people than I do, except they all say they know me, but I've never met them because... But there's a way of teasing the outer forms out of things and finding the inner place where they reverberate.
I think we need to know, forgive me, yeah. You said there's a way of teasing. We need to know what that way is.
Yeah.
We need to, just a very less than 45 seconds example. I used to begin our elders' meetings, we'd have eight elders, with mm-hmm. an icebreaker mm-hmm. that was really deeper question, mm-hmm. so we get to know each other better. And on one occasion, I said, can you share with the rest of the group what the latest experience with awe is mm-hmm. that you had?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it was just, it was 6 in the morning, and I've already had 3 experiences, and so I'm figuring this is going to be a no-brainer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling you, we went around the group so slowly. And the best most people could come up with is, well, 10 years ago I visited the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
So unless we know, and frankly, I didn't have to do the agenda, but I was just blown away. I don't remember the rest of the meeting. But if I had in my back pocket 3 easy steps to tease out of your suggestion there, that would help all of them, and I didn't help them.
Yeah. Well, you know...
I'd like us to be helped.
Yeah, great. What we're working on actually now is that you name it exactly, that we've reached a state in our country and our planet and our world where consciousness has tended to get stale in people, and so these great capacities for awe, for wonder, for registering a strong impression don't exist. And one of the things, if I can dare throw this in without getting us too far off track, is that one of the things that I'm duly noting in, you know, that people are not just for Trump around here. They're in a Trump cult. And they don't put up posters on their yard, they put up shrines. And what's happening is that, you know, you can say that whatever else is happening, Trump is making a vivid impression on the souls of the people he's making an impression on. Yeah, and that, you know, and that God love it, Biden is not going to make an impression. Hillary Clinton failed to make an impression. You know, the Democrats keep pulling forward these impressionless people, and but there's something, you know, when the lobster guys out there put out their Trump flags, and somebody figured, I've yet to see a Biden flag, but they furl these things in the wind and the breeze hits them, and, you know, it just, in all three centers, it just dances with some sort of thing, so it hits them viscerally, and, you know, and this, the whole right has somehow or another smelled its way into rekindling the dead art of impressions. So in chapter and verse, what Gurdjieff is going to say is that there isn't a short route to it, except for the short routes that nobody wants to go down, like the route you went down. You know, traumatic accidents, you know, can heighten your power of impression. Falling desperately in love can heighten your power.
These guys went down.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm convinced the only shortcut in the spiritual life is through suffering.
Yeah, yeah.
No one's going to choose that.
Yeah, exactly. So suffering will wake up impressions. What we've been working on with these exercises is very interestingly that if you can invite sensation, you know, just this simple bodily rotation and invite your arm to fill with sensation and your leg, it already makes a difference. It already makes you more alive as you walk out and more balanced and more able to receive impressions. And then if you can add to that, these dimensions we're adding with the I and the am, if you can connect a slightly higher sense of aliveness, which you can jumpstart yourself through attention placed in the limbs of your body, so that you bring yourself into a slightly more balanced and alive state, impressions will come in more powerfully. And then if you learn to do this I am, which we were taken through this morning, with the I on the eye and sensation of the chest, meaning you can put your sensation, you can put your attention where you want, and you get the feeling of that, and the eye somehow reverberating with the expansive part of you, and the am reverberating with the embodied part of you. If you begin to get the whole of the sense of yourself that way, you wake yourself up to being more impression amenable. That's what he means when you build this three-centered platform. And then impressions can begin to fall on you. And so that's the essential practical essence of it. And when the Gurdjieff work goes into wake up, wake up, wake up, it doesn't mean, you know, set your alarm clock in that sort of way. It means that when we're walking around in the stale consciousness, we aren't going to register impressions. And when we don't register impressions, we fail to come fully alive in all that's possible for us. And we also, in a deep way, betray the planet. And this was the cool part that I wanted to read you, that when I was really growing with the fact that the reason that higher, you know, these higher elements are in the atmosphere is because they need to be transformed here so they can be returned for, you know, for this full homeostasis. So he writes, and I think this is kind of fascinating, that where do I jump into this? But later, as I have already said, when most of them began to exist in a manner unbecoming to three-brain beings, that's human beings, great nature was constrained to change their fulminant sign in existence into an existence according to the principle of Itaklants. I won't go on about that, but there are two different ways of processing reality. And from then on, in the present... And from then on, in the presence of most of them, owing to their abnormal being existence, those definite crystallizations foreseen by great nature, which comprise the most important part of the second being food, and which, when assimilated by beings, are transformed into substances for the coating and perfecting of their Khesjan body, gradually cease to be assimilated either consciously or automatically for this purpose. In other words, we gradually stop breathing. You know, and everybody knows this is true. When you look at people and you ask them to breathe and you stop them in midair, you know, most of what passes for breathing in our world today is not breathing. It's truncated, chest only if you get down even that far. Sometimes people don't breathe from, you know, deeper than their neck. It's not connected to the diaphragm. Nobody knows whether it goes in and out or up and down. You know, this choppy staccato, we don't breathe anymore. And of course, the minute anything scares us, what's the first thing we do? We hold our breath. You know? So the abnormality that we are not ingesting, either consciously or even unconsciously, the elements that are actually latent in the air, not only inviting but demanding our ingestion through conscious breathing, go unused, untransformed. And when he says that when these substances gradually cease to be assimilated, either consciously or automatically for this purpose, and since these substances, transformed in other cosmic concentrations, kept on flowing all the time into the atmosphere of their planet, there arose in recent centuries among your unfortunate favorites yet another new disease with a specifically harmful action on them. I'm quoting a few things. Here perhaps I should add that this disease, with such a definite cause, was given different names by your favorites at different times on different parts of the surfaces of your planet. And the contemporary beings likewise gave it different names and wiseacre in all sorts of ways to explain its origin. Among the many names for this disease of theirs, the most widely used at the present time are grip, influenza, Spanish influenza, dengue, and others. Do you get what he's just said there? He's just said that the failure to absorb and assimilate for the second being body, the Khesjan body, the substances concentrated in the planetary atmosphere that come to us, results, since they have to be used in a certain way, they take the form of another concentration called viruses, resulting in what he's actually saying was that the Spanish influenza was, of course, the 2018 pandemic, right?
1918.
Sorry, yeah, get my centuries mixed up. You know, but, and you can laugh at that hilariously, but maybe a tad nervously. Because he said that really, you know, that in his own kind of wacky way, that these viruses, and we know that viruses have really sort of gone mad in the past, you know, century or so, that their origin really is that they become the detritus, if you want to put it that way, of our own failure to participate, which in our not only invited but absolutely compulsory, obligation to develop second body, our Khesjan body, which allows us to be the bridges across the Mipha shock point. Okay, so it's because we got completely secularized. Because we forgot how to breathe, because we forgot how to live in any sort of three-centered awareness, because our minds only got prioritized, to the point where we gradually forgot anything that wasn't created by our minds. That therefore, you know, what's a good higher element gonna do? You gotta be creative some way. Let's be a virus and wreck a little havoc. But I think it's a very interesting clue to not entirely lose track of this alleged link between failure to develop second body, which as we've seen is only really developed in us through the conscious ingestion and breathing and through our own work with as we worked this morning with conscious suffering, conscious labor, intentional suffering and love, that we have a disease that is indeed airborne, that is indeed transmitted in the atmosphere, but it's because it's a pathology of the atmosphere, a collective pathology of the atmosphere, and it's in our refashioning our broken relationship with the second being food, that our principal work of healing can take place. And I would still put that out as a bottom line for imaginal wisdom work during this next 9 months, if that's what they are. That this is enough of a lead for me, and it corresponds enough to what I'm actually seeing and sensing, that I'm willing to run with it, that the work of conscious breathing is not going to hurt anybody and might combined with the other elements that we've talked about this morning, conscious labor, intentional suffering, create some ways to defuse toxin in the environment, which we now see not as toxicity but as misdirected holiness, to re-ingest, to build up in ourselves the bodies that can bridge between the worlds, and at the same time to liberate into our planet the foods that we talked about. Gentleness, peace, forbearance, loving kindness, that can at least do some triage to this deepening psychic sickness, both individually and collectively, that we all feel. It's for me worth a shot, but we have to start by stopping being afraid of air, and realizing that a lot of stuff is that things have gotten they've gotten clumped and clustered. And as the work of breathing over a planet takes place, that a certain redistribution and reassimilation at that level is there to happen.
Cynthia, so, sorry, I just have a question. Are you familiar with the breathwork movement that's millennials, and what are the younger ones called, Andrew? Younger than us? Yeah, the Z kids. I mean, it's like one of the fastest growing practices among young people, breathwork.
I'm not surprised. You know, I was going to talk a little bit for the rest of the day. I want to talk on some variations on Tonglen, which is the great and classic old Tibetan practices, shamanic in origin, basically, that for the healing and cleansing of pathology through conscious breathing. But I'm not surprised with young kids, particularly since in schools now for a generation, you know, as part of stress management programs, kids have been taught to breathe. You know, take three deep breaths, you know, there's already been a sort of predisposition to look in that direction.
It's a whole movement of actual breathwork practice.
Yes.
Like, I think kind of like along the Kundalini line, but it's just fascinating that in this time, given what you're saying, that that would be such a rising practice, almost intuitively, the collective human consciousness is going where it needs to go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think breath is the breath and the ancient sciences that undergird the holy nature of the exchange that goes on in breath are a pretty sane starting point. There's something we can do. There are things that we can do according to our conditions, you know, that almost everybody has some place they can go to breathe consciously, no matter how fearful and contaminated the environment is. And in the places that are particularly open and giving and generous and free, to lean into it even more strongly on behalf of other places which are more under the gun. So the classic practice of Tong Glen has to be led up to gradually. In a way, it was sort of unfortunate when that great Rinpoche wrote the Tibetan Book of Death and Dying and put the practice of Tong Glen out there. And it's a very, very powerful practice. But to an American mind, or to a Western mind, skewed to personal narrative and personal efficacy in a way that an Eastern mind can't even imagine, it sounded like, I'm going to come in and sit by the bedside of my suffering grandmother and consciously ingest her pain and consciously blow out breathing, and she will be, you know. It became all about me rather than all about breath. And it became very, very quickly constrained to very specific aims. And it became too ego-referential. It won't work there. So I will at the end of this session be talking a little bit about the actual Tong Glen as intentional ingestion of toxin. But I want to start in a different way with this, because the starting is with what we worked with this morning. The starting is with breathing. And one of the things that Gurdjieff was very, very adamant about was breathing for him is simply the natural rhythm of breathing. That the one kind of dangerous thing when people start running off to all kinds of breath work is that you need really good guidance, because there's some kinds of breath work that can really land people in very difficult places, and Gurdjieff landed in one such place. You know, that there are many, many practices that have artificial hesitations of the breath. You breathe in, you hold it, you breathe out, you breathe into a count, you breathe out to a count. Those kinds of practices need to be done under a teacher, and under a teacher who's well-lineaged in the teaching they're lineaged in. And Gurdjieff had somehow picked up a practice in his early travels that had him holding his breath for ridiculously long times, and he came to a teacher and showed his dervish teacher this breath practice he learned, and his teacher says, cut it out immediately and never do that again. That because you can screw up your autonomic nervous system big time. So the Gurdjieffian breathing exercises are wonderful and safe in that they never violate the body's natural intelligence to breathe. Breathe in, breathe out. And to not mess around with it. Just do it consciously. Just be present. Don't screw with your natural rhythm, when you bring your attention to it, it will slow down and it will go deeper. That's all you need. So the start that we were listening to this morning in Make Strong, the start of breathe in, bringing your attention in the region of the chest to I, breathe out, bringing your attention, the sensation to the whole of your embodied it on am. That's a very, very good basic conscious breathing practice in the terms of this that will also bring you the doubled attention with the I am. And just to practice that a little bit, I am, I am. Really getting a feeling so they aren't just empty words in a liturgy, but as Gurdjieff said in the atmosphere exercise, so that they're actually a felt sense self of the fact that miracle of miracles, you actually exist. And I would say start there as basic breathing. And don't go anywhere else until you can do that so simply that you know that it's not you that's doing it, that it's something else that's doing it, because it's when your personal will and ego get too messed up in it that you're going to get in trouble. So, I like then, before you get into the more hardcore Tonglen, to start with then the sense of breathing in the aliveness, the fullness, and breathing out some sort of response to it. Breathing in the abundance, breathing out whatever that triggers in you, gratitude. Breathing in those particles from on high, all of this that is in this merciful environment for our healing and transformation and perfection, all of this that's given to us and everybody gratuitously. Breathe it in like in the four ideals exercise. And whatever that elicits in you in its feeling tone, breathe it out. Gratitude, breathe it out. Awe, breathe it out. Strength, breathe it out. Abundance. So again, you get the sense in you that you're receiving and that you're giving, and you're not pushing it around with your ego. That if you simply open your chest and breathe in, the sense of the abundance will hit you. The sense of the absolute freaky wonder that you breathe at all. But here I am, one breath later, and I'm still on the planet. You know, there'll come a time when that doesn't happen. But until then, the miracle. The miracle. So get used to that cycle and do that for a while. And it's sort of proto-Tonglen, that you begin to participate in the exchange in a conscious and volitional way. Now, the taking in of toxicity is the real heart of the classic, Tibetan Buddhist shamanic practice. And I can't give you more than an overview of this because I'm not lineaged in that practice, and to do more than to give you an overview would be a bad spiritual and technical mistake. But what I can share with you somewhat safely is that it is work that can be done safely. I've been with, you know, I had this amazing time for a while in Bhutan. It was a short visit, but we got some really pretty strong teaching from powerful Bhutanese Buddhist teachers that demonstrated how it was done. But the key to it is that your ego has to be completely out of the way, because otherwise you're going to get scared. You're going to start wondering how much you can bear. It's going to be like Peter walking on the water, and all of a sudden you go, oops. You know? So the ego has to be absolutely stock still. And the only thing that works is a will that's deeper than the ego, and an aim and intention and a focus. And until you have that, you don't mess around with this. But to even know that it's doable becomes important. And that there comes a way in which, if you work with this lightly, as a kind of add-on to the breathing practices that you can sustain, it becomes possible to take in some small bit of the anguish, the pain body that's befitting our planet. And you can do it either by naming it or by just feeling it. The fear, the welcoming practice is actually intro Tonglen. Because this is exactly what you're doing. You take this afflictive emotion, you take this pain that you're feeling, and rather than running from it or trying to neutralize it, you say, welcome. You breathe it in. You take it into yourself. And then, breathing out, I let it go. I let it go. And, another of the brilliant things about the welcoming prayer is that it begins to get you used to that motion in a safe, gentle way. So you take in a bit of the pain body. You take it in, and because you're taking it in a transpersonal way, you know, if you're going to do this part of the practice, please put a moratorium on the word empath, because it'll kill you. Forget you're an empath if you are. Just do the practice. You know, welcome anger. Welcome, and in this way you can sit, and in a completely transpersonal way, you can take in a piece of another's pain, another's grief. You can carry a part of the suffering of our common father. And breathe out. And breathe out. That's the thing, you can't hang on to it. I let it go. I let it go. I let it go. And work like that can cautiously, quietly, I think even with groups that are not really trained and lineaged, help symbolically to name and to eat and reabsorb some of the just out of sight, unconscious, traumatic pain that we're already feeling in our country and in our world. And you don't even have to name it specifically. If you become really, really quiet and open your heart, you feel it. Just welcome. 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 You're doing Tonglen, you didn't know it. Okay? So, I think this is good work. This is holy work. This is work that reestablishes our connection with second being food, and in the same way reestablishes broken connections. As long as people are trying to deal with this pandemic in World 48, we're lost, we're victims. Because it is, I believe, a World 24-48 communications failure. And we can heal at that level. We can help at that level. Because nobody else is going to do that. Other people are going to be working on World 48. But if we are true, if it is true that something needs to flow between these realms to create both the energies and the tools and the bridges to allow healing to pour in, and healing is going to pour in from the Christic realm, then this is work we can do and must do. And must do before some miraculous vaccine does or does not show up. Because it can be done in the atmospheres, which is where the work really goes on. The final thing I would say, though, in my own kind of comments today, is that there's always a teaching that comes to us specifically. And the teaching I'm hearing over and over and over again as a refrain during the time that I'm teaching this thing is suck it in. That it's really interesting how many of the exercises have ended when we did the atmosphere. At the end, you suck it into yourself, you conserve yourself within the atmosphere. Today, we ended the four ideals with you suck it in. I'm going to pick up tomorrow with that, because those of you who've done it before know you don't just suck it in. You suck it in and then redistribute it in your own body being for healing and health and further fertilization. I use the term guardedly, but intentionally. And to the extent that Mr. Gurdjieff has his eye on us, which is a privilege I grant to the beings that can make any of this happen, the message to our group at this time, I believe, is don't be afraid to gulp it in. At this point, don't rush to being producers before you've been healed yourself. We are all the broken ones. We've all been traumatized. And the invitation is out there that for each one of us, if we're going to do the next thing that has to be done, which is to live with death behind us and not ahead of us, that it will be necessary to just step like a little child up to the fountain and allow yourself to step in and be drenched with the goodness. Suck it in. Take those four rivers of spiritual prayer and petition that you can connect with by the power of your attention, and just draw it into your being. It's for you. Conserve yourself in your atmosphere. It's for you. Don't be diffident. Because it's as we build up our capacity to receive that we build up our capacity to give. And so the message that I'm hearing that I would really want to put the emphasis on, this is not I have to fix me first and then I'll fix the world. I'm not saying that. They will happen simultaneously because they're happening in different worlds. But it takes a boldness of spirit to say, Lord, I am not ready. I am not worthy. But you're pouring the grace on me anyway and throwing down the baskets and pitchers in case I think I don't have enough. So let's go for it. Drink it in. And really make the center of your emphasis at this time in the confident receiving of that which is freely being offered to you for the sake of the healing of the entire megalocosmos. Okay? That makes sense? All right, well, that's all I have to say, except to add a final sequel to the. You know, I began by giving you my take on the Evil Lee conversation, but you know, as kind of happens in funny ways when these kinds of conscious intentional groups get formed at the cusp of things get moving. And the long and short of it is, facilitated by Buddy Parker, Tim Shriver and Eva Lee had a long conversation today to begin to carry forward the question that Tim asked about, can you develop modelings that will assess health value, the spread of goodness, if you want, the contagion of wellness. Can we develop models that are not skewed to disease, but are really skewed to healing? And so we don't know where that's going to go yet, but the idea got born and raised in Bill Espinosa's living room last night. Alhamdulillah. So anybody got anything to say? Tim or Buddy or anybody else? Yeah.
Well, just to say thank you, Buddy.
Yeah.
And just to say that if the elegance of mathematics and the humility of that ambitious spirit that she is can be blended with the search for patterns and energy fields that actually grow the second body or nurture or feed the second body, if we could actually think that mathematics could and probabilities could help us see that more clearly or understand its workings more dynamically, it would be quite an extraordinary outcome.
It would. Particularly
if Bobby McPherson do that?
Sorry.
Didn't Bobby McPherson do that?
Did who? Yeah.
Yes. Don't worry, be happy.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But it's really interesting because that I said earlier that radial energy or psychic energy, you know, we know it has effect in the world, but science has so far declined to measure it. You know, and the Bhutanese Buddhists got on this early on when they tried to develop measures for gross national happiness. And that got really poo-pooed by people, but it was actually good math. That I knew the ladies that invented that helped them to develop the measures. And they tested a whole bunch of things that went into their economy to measure economic health. And it wasn't just gross national product. It was essentially the degree of satisfaction, the degree of spiritual growth of their citizens. It was lovely. The lady who put that one together, Sabina Alkier, is actually a member of our extended network. She became a late protege of Thomas Keating, and I know her quite well. So there are some kind of people working between the realms. Sabina also, in a very interesting way, the Bhutanese Buddhists took her under wing and have been teaching her a lot of the inner craft that usually only got taught to monks on meditation retreats. So she's a Western lady with a professorship at Oxford University, retired from a position at the World Bank in order to run this other thing. She's a heavy hitter in the world. but is also beginning to develop mathematical models for measuring radial energy. And this project you've got started has some promise for doing that, which could really flip the frame of how people are envisioning, you know, the meaning and the flow of life. So we'll stay tuned.
Cynthia, I just wanted to make one short comment. There's much left to be discussed, and we can do that this evening and tomorrow. But I was present for an hour-long conversation between Tim and Eva, and as a, more of an observer as opposed to a participant. And it was extraordinary as it evolved, in that as it came to the latter half of the latter quarter of the hour, it shifted more into spirituality and the discussion of spirituality. And I think Tim was giving Eva permission, and she accepted it, to express her own spirituality as opposed to the scientific, her scientific training and background. And so what's possible, I believe, is that with Tim's support, Eva's going to use her spirituality in trying to come up with this kind of quantitative analysis and optimization, something that can give roadmaps, if you will, to the movement, to what Tim is working on, to essentially help us, society, all of us, experience those positive attributes that feed our being, our second person.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing.
I think, like, when I was in that deep well of suffering, like, I felt you fall into it, and something that just trying to listen to your body, like, I needed to go find another place to go to be around other people that were suffering as well. And so I immersed myself into this, like, inner city kitchen where others were not, like, feeling the same, like, emotions, but still in a very, like, spiritually, like, hard place, like, anger, rage, all of that, and coming up together into, like, finding each other. And service does so much to awaken your eyes to awe and wonder and beauty. And I find myself now a position that has found me with Catholic Charities, and I'm the Food for All coordinator, and I am now in rural Ohio doing food pantries with families and neighbors that, you know, are in this place of, I don't know what to do to find food. And they love coming through this line, and, like, you would think I was this really famous person. Like, all of them know my name, and, like, because I make them feel like they matter, and that beauty, and I see that beauty shining through you, that shimmer of joy and love, and it's attractive. And that's, like, when you're talking about these things that you're breathing in the air, like, we have that power to crystallize the fruits of the spirit, and so many people just don't even know that they matter, that they're loved, and I can give that to another. Like, there's some kind of pattern in all of that. Like, I don't know what it is, but I truly feel it. It's
yeah.
I don't know, very powerful.
Yeah, yeah. And April, what you just said might be a rudimentary but perfectly accurate way to respond to the question Don asked earlier. I go, tell me what these sparks are. Well, think of them as sparks of the fruits of the spirit, little bits and pieces of them that are all there and can be pulled in and
Well, I'm thinking about plants and trees and how they use the energy as photosynthesis and they put it out into energy. We as humans haven't risen to this consciousness of what plants know how to do with these things that are all around us and breathing them in and crystallizing them out into the fruits of the spirit. We can do that.
Yeah, and to use that feeding and that photosynthesis is a good metaphor. And in a funny way, if Gurdjieff is right, we human beings, perform photosynthesis, it's photosynthesis for the second body, drawing from the light of the sun and from the light of the particles to create something that gives oxygen to our otherwise suffocating planet.
Yeah, that toxicity of us breathing, they turn it into oxygen for us.
Yeah, thank you. Brilliant. Where in Ohio?
Cincinnati, the rural areas of Cincinnati.
Yeah, wow. Getting out into the hill country?
Oh, yeah.
God, takes me back. Well, okay.
I put myself there.
Okay, guys, so instructions for tonight. Does everybody know where the Fit and Fern is?
Downhill.
Right down at the bottom of this hill on the right side, on the same side of the street that Bill Espinosa's house is on. Really, really lovely restaurant. And we're due there at 6, right?
Yes, he would really appreciate us being
on time. Is he giving?
45 minutes.
Yeah, 45 minutes. And so the deal is you've paid for your dinner. If you want wine or beer with the dinner, come with a little bit extra cash or a credit card in your pocket, because there'll be a cheap option and a not cheap option. Thank you, Tim. They're not bad.
I'll keep bringing them.
No, we're not back here tonight.
I'll keep bringing these.
Yeah, tonight is for festivity.
Okay.
And you can party as long as you want. Yes, Mary Ellen?
Just one other thing. Although it's not a cruise ship, keep a little bit in mind the idea of first and second seatings. I think... What about 7:45?